From WXXI News, this is Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, it is Innovation Friday, and this hour, the innovation starts right here in our area with some really remarkable research and innovative work being done to address problems here and around the world and the way we respond to them. And here are some examples. Now that the Ebola crisis in West Africa seems to be subsiding or at least under control, and we'll find out if that characterization is fair in a moment, researchers are hoping that a new app will be able to help in how responses to future epidemics pan out. A research associate from the University of Rochester Medical Center is going to explain what he's working on. We're also going to look at how mapping disasters and looking at maps from multi-spatial perspectives can inform recovering and forward planning. And we'll talk about the value of information, especially in places where there are AIDS epidemics. Sometimes we take for granted just how much access we have to information in general, information in an emergency. And we're going to talk about how text messaging can play an impact with Amina Qatari from RIT School of Communication. Amina, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Brian Tomaszewski's here. He's an assistant professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology, the author of a book called Geographic Information Systems for Disaster Management. Brian, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And also here is Solomon Abiola, who's a research associate at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Solomon, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
You're the one with the tight schedule, so we start with you. And we're going to start with a look at Ebola. For example, well, help me pull back a little bit here. So much attention on Ebola a year ago. And the expectation is that we all sort of mentally move on. But how are things in general now in terms of Ebola containment, et cetera?
I think it's true that a lot of the international body has started to move on from Ebola, and the new thing on the scene is MERS in South Korea, but there's still concern and risk around Ebola. Liberia was fortunate to be declared, you know, Ebola-free, but Guinea and Sierra Leone are still facing their own outbreaks and so forth. I think it's one of those things that we need to keep a close eye on, and obviously with MERS cropping up, make sure that as a globe, we start to fight infectious diseases together, not just as, you know, Asia or the Middle East or Africa are having these outbreaks.
MERS, again, is that's something that we had heard in recent years, I think, a little bit about MERS. MERS in South Korea, you said right now?
Yes. So before we had the Ebola outbreak, we were all, you know, fixated on the MERS outbreak that was taking place in Saudi Arabia, where up to 1,000 people had died. And now, you know, it's spread over to South Korea, where a lot of the schools have shut down and there's about 20 or 30 deaths.
So what do you want to do through your research and your work? What do you want to see happen?
I think that using smartphone technologies, we can develop applications that can send people to have their human mobility patterns tracked. So this is similar to a lot of the technology already used for, you know, things like Facebook, Instagram, these kinds of things that require your location data. But using this to help prevent the spread of infectious diseases and also to help model them. So, you know, here in the U.S., we don't have an Ebola outbreak, we don't have MERS, but, you know, the biggest concern for us as citizens is influenza. And, you know, we've had our experiences in the past with H1N1, the SARS outbreak, and so forth. So how can we better be prepared for these outbreaks in the future?
And we're talking about tracking it.
Correct.
Okay. First of all, how do you do that? Walk me through how it's being tracked right now, or when you're looking at the landscape of how we are tracking disease currently. You've got to first figure out what are we doing now and what are we not doing well, right? Walk me through that.
So currently, a lot of our tracking, you know, we have epidemiologists out in the field. They look at animal specimens, you know, they're trying to see if it's spreading over. For example, with Ebola, it came from a bat, which then infected a child. And also looking at, okay, well, where is patient zero located? Finding patient zero can take, you know, weeks, potentially a month in the case with Ebola. But what can we do with smartphones is that we know where people are. We know how they're moving in a population. We can simulate that in real time. So basically, you install this application as Node on your smartphone, and this collects information. It asks you survey questions. And the reason why we're asking survey questions is things like currently a lot of the modeling we do is very mathematical. And if, as a policymaker, you might say, well, the solution to, let's say, a MERS outbreak in the United States is we're going to have a massive vaccination program. Well, that's all great, but what if half the citizens in Rochester say we don't want to participate in a vaccination strategy? You need to know that before you go to implement that because you have limited resources. You have to act very fast with these infectious diseases. So this is something that the smartphone application will enable us to do. It also enables us to simulate the spread of an outbreak by mining all this information and analyzing it, something that we can't do currently with a lot of the techniques that we're employing.
You call it Node. For our audience who heard him mention Node, that's the name of the app.
Correct.
Okay. How far along in development now?
So currently, we've basically fleshed out most of the application. We're adding some surveys, and these are based on World Health Organization questions to assess quality of life. So things like, you know, how much sleep do you get and so forth, because these can be indicators of how resilient you might be to disease. The other thing that we're doing is that starting the beginning of next month, we'll be installing this application on 100 or so smartphone users in Lagos, Nigeria. So Lagos, Nigeria is one of the cities, Nigeria being West Africa, where they had the Ebola outbreak, but they were able to contain it by being fortunate to immediately track down second-degree contacts. So with Ebola, the important thing is that when you get this patient zero, you have to find out who are their first-degree contacts and who are those second-degree contacts, because that's the only way you can really get control of the situation. However, if the person arrives, you know, in a comatose state or they're sick and die, you know, you can't ask those questions. Whereas with this application, we'd be able to say, okay, the last 7 days they were in this part of the city, we need to deploy, you know, health officials there, screen the population, versus having to track now everybody in the entire city.
How have they done in general? How would you rate the work they've done in actually tracking it?
So I think Nigeria did a very textbook example case of tracking it. I think that was because they were able to transition from their polio protocols quickly over to fighting the Ebola outbreak. And I think that that's an example that we should show to other developing countries, is that ability to switch from a healthcare model that's already working to solve another health problem. That's something that we commonly do here in the U.S. You know, we take our tools that we use for SARS, bioterrorism, and so forth, and we also use that for the Ebola outbreak. So that's what allowed them to immediately, you know, contain the situation and prevent it from killing thousands like it has in Liberia and Sierra Leone.
You were recently in Nigeria.
Correct.
Good chance for you to learn up close. What else did you feel you were able to do there?
So when I was there in the country, I was able to meet with the president of the Nigerian Academy of Sciences. And so he had given a lot of literature reviews and talks to the World Health Organization about the work Nigeria was doing in terms of Ebola. And it also allowed me to be on the ground and see how, you know, the population responds to these outbreaks. So I was there previously last month and also when their Ebola outbreak started. And so, you know, you have the same feelings that you see in America, which is, you know, initially the population is kind of, you know, very concerned because it's like, it's really up to the government to be responsive, issue protocols, and so forth. And so some of the problems that Nigeria faced were similar to here in the U.S. when we had the patient in Texas, and how the nursing associations were concerned that their hospitals weren't doing enough or providing enough guidelines immediately. Fortunately, here in the Rochester area, our hospital systems were able to, you know, immediately say these are the protocols they're going to be following if there's an Ebola outbreak here.
Mike wants to know about privacy concerns with and who collects the data. So, okay, let's talk about that. We're talking to Solomon Abiola, who is a research associate at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Mike's asking about privacy concerns. So Node, again, if you're just joining us, Node is an app that once it's available, any of us could download it onto our smartphone for what cost?
So this would be a free application.
Free application. And by the way, I would imagine this kind of tracking works once you get widespread use and sort of practice of most of the population, much of a population using an app like this, right?
Correct.
How much buy-in do you need from the public for this?
So we're looking at buy-in of probably about 20% at least, predominantly because if you think about a lot of the patterns that we exhibit as humans are very repetitive. A lot of us work with coworkers, so the whole 9 to 5, we're all going to work at Strong Memorial Hospital, all going to work at WXXI. You know, we're all, you know, so you can use that as a model potentially for other people in that community. So it's not that you need everybody to be tracked, but a sufficient amount of the population. In terms of the privacy, you know, obviously with a lot of the concern here in the U.S. with the NSA and globally around privacy, that's the reason why we're making this an application. So there's been research that was done in East Africa where people had downloaded cell phone records, used this to track the spread of malaria, but obviously we couldn't do something like that here in the U.S. If we downloaded all the Verizon or AT&T data, people would, you know, freak out, even if you said, hey, you know, we prevented SARS from spreading week one. People would still be concerned, like you said, about the privacy. So that's why we make this an application. So similar to other apps which are doing this, like Google Maps, they know where your location is. Uber knows where you are. These are things that you can send because you as a citizen are receiving some sort of feedback from it that's worth you giving up this information. At the same time, the information that the policymaker or the healthcare provider sees is just interactions between users. So they don't see like your actual location history saying, oh, this is what you've been doing for the last 30 days. It's more like, did you interact with this person who I presume to be patient zero? If you did, where did those interactions occur? that's the information that's actually valuable to the policymaker. And it's also respecting your privacy as an individual to say, we're not going to show that, oh, you were in the stadium for 5 days or something like that. That's useless information to the policymaker. And it's also something that you might not want to be revealing, depending on who's asking these questions.
You've clearly thought about the privacy angle.
Correct.
Now, when it comes to how Node works, I download it onto my phone. Then what do I need to do manually in terms of uploading any information, or does it work on its own? How does it work?
So a lot of the interaction with the application is very autonomous. So all the sensor data is being collected autonomously. This is location. You know, we can look at things like how well are people sleeping, the population, and so forth. Occasionally, biweekly, in the study that we're going to be doing in Nigeria, we'll ask questionnaires. These are about 10 to 20 questions just to assess things like, okay, you know, do you feel like you have access to healthcare in your community? Because these kinds of questions that you really can't ask with mathematical modeling, you can get now with these surveys, and that will help inform better health policy solutions in terms of infectious disease outbreaks or even non-communicable diseases.
So the questions you want to answer going forward now, what is still unanswered in your own mind about Node and whether it can work in tracking and helping prevent further spread of disease?
So I think the two most important questions are basically looking at how the veracity of the data itself. Because obviously, you know, when you're in buildings and so forth, we're going to lose connectivity and stuff like that. So it's more like how much information is actually needed to develop an infectious disease platform that will help us prevent the spread of these diseases. At the same time, we're looking at how are people engaging with the application. Because in general, the mobile health landscape, you know, has been met with the same problems as drug adherence. People, you know, use an app and then they're done with it. So how do we keep people engaged? I think those are going to be the two biggest problems. But I think because of the concern now with infectious diseases and a lot of diseases that we're facing, there's, you know, no cures or immediate vaccines. I think there's an initial concern from the population that wouldn't it be nice to at least you have an app that's saying, here's the nearest hospital to receive some sort of treatment. These are the things that are available to you so that when you go looking for that information, you're not, you know, just all of a sudden in a state of panic, which then becomes a problem for governments because they can't control a panicked population.
And Solomon, I know you've stressed that we started by talking about Ebola. Certainly it could apply to Ebola, but is there any sort of a limit to what it might be able to track? I mean, what do you envision it working to track?
So I think the two most important things, and we're going to talk about this later with two other speakers, is we can use it for infectious diseases, so obviously the MERS outbreak, but also I think it's something that can be used in disaster responses. So with the earthquake that happened in Nepal, or even with, you know, Hurricane Sandy and Katrina, one of the biggest concerns is, you know, how do you find where people were? You know, you have to go out there, search every grid in a local environment. But if you use, you know, an application like this, we could pull up, okay, before the disaster hit, 12 hours ago, this is where everybody was. We can know, well, this is where the elderly people are located. We know that they're not going to be able to survive under rumble for, you know, 24 hours. So we need to treat them immediately. This is their last known location. Whereas younger populations, maybe they were in a stronger structure building, so we'll treat them later. So this is something the application would allow us to do. Because even as a developed country, we do have our own limitations. And so it's really about how fast can you respond to these disasters before they become out of control.
All right. Some of the advanced notes sent our way, both from our Innovation Trail team and also the University of Rochester and the Medical Center, indicate some other questions that I think are important here. Because I'm hearing what you're trying to do, and I'm thinking about, well, of course, I would put Node on my phone. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping that to prevent, take Ebola. The concern that Americans had, and maybe it was a little shrill last year, but concern nonetheless was, is it being contained where I don't live, somewhere else in Africa? And is Node a sustainable effort? Is this kind of thing workable in West Africa? And so we're reading that cell phone usage in West African countries range from 40% to 80%, with over 2 million Android devices in Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia alone. And so, okay, 40% sounds like a problem. 80% sounds like, you know, you can work with it. What do you make of the infrastructure and whether this can work in Africa, in West Africa?
Correct. So one of the things that we are looking at in a lot of these developing countries, in specific our study country, Nigeria, one of the NSF aims is to assess, well, how sustainable are these operations? The reason why we're focusing on smartphones, even though a lot of, you know, countries have a mix of, you know, mobile phone this like dumb phone and smartphones, is because we see this as a tool that should prepare us for future health crises and responses. So we're trying to no longer do the, you know, usual, which is focus on today, there's an Ebola outbreak, how do we solve it with tools on the ground? But rather, how do you make this something that's part of these countries' healthcare processes as they're growing forward? So here, for example, in the U.S., we're starting to integrate a lot of telemedicine. You know, we're not waiting till the day that, you know, telemedicine is the only option we have or something like that, but it's how can we ease these into our current workflow? So that's the way I see Node working, is to say, well, in the future, you know, by 2030, at the rate at which smartphones are growing in Africa and globally, most of the population is going to have this technology. So by then, we don't want to say there's another outbreak and now we need to respond and develop some application. It's better to say...
You want to be ready.
Exactly. It's ready. We're ready to go with it and so forth.
Is there nothing like this out there right now?
Correct. There isn't any application that's like this. There's a lot of studies that have been looking into human mobility tracking. But what we're really trying to do here is to create something that a Ministry of Health or a government organization can actually employ in part of their solutions for fighting diseases, whether they're AIDS or, you know, non-communicable ones like, you know, Parkinson's disease or something along those lines.
Okay. And, you know, and again, some of what's out there now, maybe nothing quite like this, but the BBC has their WhatsApp group chat to share audio, text message alerts, anything to help people with public health information. Do you look at that as, you know, a success story, as a cautionary tale? What do you make of it?
I think that it's a very responsive type of technology, and I think that they're focusing on a different type of thing than what we're doing with Node. So even here, if we had a SARS outbreak or something, the government would, you know, provide websites to learn about SARS, but it's not really an interactive platform. It's kind of like, here's information, you know, take it and do what you want to do with it. Whereas I feel like, you know, as ordinary citizens who aren't, let's say, a health professional or who might not be connected to a doctor in the family or something, they would like to know, like you said, was I in an Ebola-infected area? Okay, where are those areas? Where should I avoid? The same way when we have a natural disaster, you know, if there's a hurricane coming, we warn people, you know, to do certain activities, to relocate to higher ground and so forth. We don't wait for it to hit and then give you the information. So I see that as something that's going to be very useful with this platform.
Talking to Solomon Abiola, a research associate at the University of Rochester Medical Center, for just a few more minutes. So, all right, so looking forward, the soonest we could see Node available for our smartphones would be when?
Probably sometime late next year.
Late 2016.
Correct. In terms of like something that everybody can be using. We are hoping to test it here actually in the Rochester area. So we'll definitely be sending out information about that when that becomes available.
How do you, well, I guess you test it by people using it?
Correct.
But what kind of testing or information tracking would you be doing in our area?
So here we'd be focusing on something like influenza. So right now it's not flu season, but we might employ the same tactics to show, okay, well, how is the flu spreading? You know, where should we be putting up, you know, vaccine clinics? Right now, you know, we do it based on empirical data or data that's been collected in surveys and so forth, but it might turn out that certain populations in the city are not able to access these vaccine stations, or, you know, we should restructure other things based on how people are moving in the population.
I would think that something like Ebola, is it easier to track? Then, let me rephrase that. Ebola, we had a hard enough time tracking. I'm trying to think of tracking people in terms of whether we've had contact with possible patients. And Ebola, because it is less common, is it less common than the flu? And this is where Solomon's going to say maybe the flu is not as common as I'm thinking. But I'm thinking if the flu is more common, is it harder to really track and effectively know who was in contact with whom and how things moved throughout our community?
So you bring up a good point. I don't think the tracking is going to be the issue, but rather what diagnosis are going to be able to use to say you have the flu. That's really what's going to be important, because it is more common than Ebola. And so some of the information we would be looking at is things like we would have surveys that ask, oh, do you have a high temperature? These are indicators that you might have, you know, a flu-like response and so forth. So it's kind of like developing the correct questions that will allow us to determine who in the population is actually having a flu and who's just having, you know, a headache or, you know, an allergic reaction or something like that. But as you mentioned, yes, it is more common. I think what's more important here is that we want to assess the severity of it. Because what we don't want to say is that, okay, you know, flu season this year is way worse than it's been the last 10 years, and we realize that 2 months too late, because by then it's out of control. As some of us were aware, last flu season, the vaccines that we developed weren't, you know, applicable to most of the flu viruses that people were getting out of the country. Fortunately, you know, this wasn't like H1N1 or anything like that, but you could imagine if we had messed up our vaccine strategy and now we were facing, you know, an actual full on scale flu outbreak.
This has the potential, it sounds, to be pretty remarkable. What's the feedback so far been for it?
It's been very well received. We've been talking to people in the Nigerian government, so at the Ministry of Health there, and even here, people in the local community, because we do a lot of work here in Rochester with the CDC as one of their sentinel networks for infectious diseases. So it's really trying to look at on a global level, how can we, you know, collaborate and work together? Because diseases don't have boundaries. That, you know, we saw that with Ebola. We've seen that with SARS. I think it's becoming more and more apparent because of the technological age that we live in. And so I think people are looking for solutions that are no longer just focused on, okay, well, if we stop it in Africa, it won't touch us. It doesn't work like that. The doctor gets infected who was sent there, comes back to New York City, a massive city, and, you know, everybody in the U.S. could be at risk.
Ideally, 5 years from now, more than 20%, if that's the baseline, let's say 40% of us have Node downloaded on our phones, and the next Ebola, whatever happens that is coming next, before it can really get going, you're hoping that Node will allow the proper figures to identify what's going on, where it's likely to be, and then how to combat it?
Correct.
You know, we talked about quarantine with Ebola, but not even just quarantine. It's making sure vaccines are available, clinics, et cetera.
Correct. So I think this, what we don't see here, I guess, in America is we have a belief that, you know, we have an abundance or infinite resources. I think that's because, fortunately, as a country, we've never had to face, you know, massive, large scale epidemics like a lot of these other developing countries. But we do have our own limitations. I mean, even when the Ebola outbreak happened, we only had 3 institutions in the U.S. capable of supporting 9 patients. So if we had a full-scale, you know, outbreak, we as a country would have had to come up with ad hoc, you know, solutions that might not have been, you know, very attractive, you know, shutting down hospitals or something like that to treat Ebola patients. And, you know, imagine if like a regional hospital like Strong said, we have an Ebola patient. I don't think most people in Rochester would say, well, they're going to go there and give birth to their baby or go and get their colonoscopy. So now you have people who are supposed to get basic medical treatment saying they're not going to the hospital. So you have a compounding of health issues. You have this infectious disease outbreak. Now you have an increase in other diseases and things that are supposed to be managed and kept tabs on because, you know, people are saying, I don't want to go to that hospital.
Yeah, and to your point on the way we can be flat-footed about these things, correct me if I'm wrong, but I felt like all throughout late summer and into the fall, there was all this conversation on how quickly can we get a vaccine made? As if the best way to combat a possible deadly outbreak is to wait for the outbreak and then start working on a vaccine. I mean, it's just not fast enough. If Ebola had gotten really uncontained, we couldn't have relied on vaccines, I wouldn't have thought, at that point, right?
Correct. There's this classic historical example of an outbreak that actually occurred in Britain where it was spreading via the water. And it wasn't until this guy had basically, this is a perfect example of geospatial modeling, had removed the handle from the well that the outbreak basically started to die down. So that's an example of where, yes, quarantine measures or looking at where are things sourcing from and so forth might be the best solution immediately, because even now we're still working on an Ebola vaccine. But what's really helped shut down Ebola a lot was quarantine measures, making sure there are clinics, you know, to help provide water and fluid to some of the infected patients, you know, markets were, you know, closed down and so forth.
Geospatial modeling is a perfect segue. As we say goodbye to Solomon Abiola, a research associate from the University of Rochester Medical Center, that is a perfect segue to our next half hour as we begin to talk with some of our other guests. Thanks for the work that you're doing. Keep us updated on this. It's fascinating stuff and certainly does seem to have the possible application that could be have a worldwide impact. So thank you.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Short break, spatial thinking, crisis mapping, and we'll even talk about how our own information sharing devices that I'm using right now, looking at text messages, how we take it for granted and how it could have an impact in around the world as well. With our other guests who are in studio, it's Innovation Friday, and that subject right after this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, the New York State Legislature decided to do nothing to change the New York State SAFE Act in this legislative session. Was that the right decision? Should changes have been made? Gun rights advocates say they would like to see the whole thing repealed, but they were looking for some changes and they didn't get any. We'll look at registration numbers. We'll ask why firearm owners aren't registering. All of that Monday on Connections.
Clemente Pinckney led one of the nation's historic black churches.
Mother Emanuel, since 1818, has stood for freedom and worship for African Americans in South Carolina. And so it's an humbling privilege I have to serve as his pastor.
Mourners, including President Obama, gather at his funeral. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That'll be this afternoon at 4 with news locally and nationally on this, your NPR news station.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It's Innovation Friday, and this hour we're looking at how we handle problems, whether it's disease or disaster management, and how to do it more effectively. We had a conversation in our first half hour with a researcher who is trying to put together an app that will help us better track the spread of diseases. And he mentioned a concept that Brian Tomaszewski's ears perked up. He's an assistant professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology and the author of the book that I'm looking at right now called Geographic Information Systems for Disaster Management. And immediately, Brian, your mind went to cholera. Tell us about what happened.
Yeah, if you heard Solomon in the previous segment, he talked about use of tracking cholera outbreaks in London, and that's the famous John Snow cholera map that I reproduced an image of that in my book. And the basic idea was that Dr. Snow used a map of the city of London to plot cases of where cholera was breaking out. And by using a map to visually represent the data, he saw a pattern occurring that led him to a hypothesis that there was a contaminated well. And when they removed the well, lo and behold, the cholera cases started going away. Today, we think of that as very simple, but at the time, that was very revolutionary, and it's often cited as beginning of epidemiology, spatial analysis, and so forth.
Spatial analysis, and we're taking it to different levels now, but just in spatial thinking. First of all, define it for us. What is spatial thinking?
That's a good question. I hope I can give you a good definition of it. I sometimes think of it as using literature on the topic, using the properties of space to structure, solve, and reason about problems. So to put that in more practical terms, for example, you might use your fingers to count. When you use your fingers to count, you're arranging things spatially to kind of organize them. We use a spatial metaphor often for talking about time. The event is far off in the future. Mm-hmm. This is far away and so forth to understand the passage of time. But also you can think about it, too, in terms of navigating and any kind of problem that's spatial in nature. So when you're traveling in a new city, you have to think about, say, going from your hotel to like where your event is if you're on a business trip and so forth. And I think it's just a way of how you can really understand the world around you and think about things at different scales and distances and so forth. And you can support your spatial thinking with things like maps or now even ubiquitous GPS receivers that most of us in the United States who have smartphones have with GPS capability linked into things like Google Maps or in-car navigation systems in cars and so forth.
And so spatial thinking can help us with disaster management. And let's take an example. I mentioned that last winter in the Buffalo area, there were parts, little bands that had 3 feet of snow in less than 24 hours. I think we saw 7 or 8 people lose their lives. We saw property destroyed. But people trapped in their own homes, for example. And there were all these questions about how do you deal with it? How do you route snow removal? How do you get supplies to people in need? All of these problems. Spatial thinking can apply how?
Well, you know, again, it's interesting. It in some ways ties back to what Solomon was talking about, being proactive instead of reactive to disasters. So thinking spatially about your planning. So if you were to use something like a geographic information system tool to model out how snowfalls could possibly occur, you could think about the spatial dynamics of where you have vulnerable populations, where do they live in relationship to evacuation routes, how does that affect perhaps moving them to shelters and so forth. So you have a sense of the spatial dynamics of a potential problem before they would even occur.
How did they do? I mean, are you someone who takes a look at how we're responding to our own problems around here? And do you find yourself thinking they're not using crisis mapping, spatial thinking effectively? Is that sort of just a quirk of your work, having put a book together on this?
Yeah, I found when putting the book together that you're really seeing the same thing over and over and over again. I mean, things are making progress. I think as natural disasters and even now things like disease outbreaks are, you know, world populations are growing. There are bigger disasters of bigger scale and scope. I think our mechanisms for dealing with them are improving, but you still come back to the same problems of coordinating people, You know, we were talking about Nepal and social media and coordinating like a big international disaster relief effort. How do you bring people from the outside into a country to deal with a problem and so forth? And everybody's doing mapping, and are they sharing and coordinating it? And how effective are the maps? There hasn't been really a lot of real research on the effectiveness necessarily of how well maps that have been produced are helping with disaster response and so forth. So yes, I think things are improving, but I think there's always this constant level of improvement. And honestly, will we ever get perfect disaster response? I don't know. And how would you even know if, how would you measure that and so forth?
Well, both of my guests who are in studio for the remainder of the hour on this Innovation Friday are doing some pretty remarkable things, not only here, but around the world. And Brian, for example, building spatial thinking skills in Rwandan secondary students. This is a fascinating project, and I want to know how you came to it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that project just concluded, and we have some connections at RIT to Rwanda. So we had a grant from the UK Department for International Development, and it was a program called Innovation for Education, where they were interested in trying new educational approaches in the Rwandan educational sector. And we came at that project with the perspective of spatial thinking. Because in the United States, there has been efforts at trying to promote and advocate for spatial thinking in K through 12 education, not just in things you might think of initially like geography, but also in engineering, in science, and so forth. So we wanted to try to take that model on advocating for spatial thinking and apply it into Rwanda. And so what we did there was with our funding, we were able to buy tablet computers and GPS receiver devices. And we went in and did studies on basically they're called spatial thinking tests, where we gave our students a test of their spatial thinking ability. And then we did educational intervention and then we measured them again.
Now, hold on. How do you test spatial thinking ability? I want to know how you test it.
That's a good question. We drew upon some existing literature where some other researchers had developed a spatial thinking ability test. And it's based on things like map reading interpretation skills, relating geographic data to numerical data, map orientation. For example, you always assume that north is up on a map, mm-hmm. but what if you had to, if north was down, but you still had to solve a routing problem?
Which, by the way, I hate when when Google Maps does that. It converts it to this live map, and all of a sudden it starts swinging the landscape around, and I just want to know where north is. I never enjoy that, by the way.
Well, that could be a good example of spatial thinking.
Are you saying I'm not a good spatial thinker?
Not necessarily you're not a good or bad one. It's just a different way of thinking spatially. For example, I have an Android phone mm-hmm. that's sort of my digital Swiss Army knife for everything now. So driving up to the studio, I use the directions, and it does give you that. It's giving you the perspective of your orientation. It's not
as
just
opposed to north,
always
south,
strictly
east, west.
Now.
Yeah, yeah. I don't like that.
Yeah. Well,
doesn't bother you though, does it?
It doesn't. No, I've gotten comfortable with it, and in some sense, I find it easier because there's been in geography there was a lot of research on people with paper maps before the digital age of taking maps. Are they rotating them to try to orient the map to the environment mm-hmm. that they're in versus always just staying with north up and then mentally rotating and so forth?
All right,
it's a skill you can develop.
After those tangents aside, back to how you're testing. And the students in Rwanda that you're testing, their spatial thinking skills are how old?
Secondary school, so they were high school students, about 15 to 17 years old.
Okay, and how they do?
Well, honestly, in terms of just pure test scores, they did poorly. I think something we have to really look at going forward, the research was the questions we used, the way they were written and so forth. That being said, though, we did see measurable progress. We had two intervention schools and then one control school, meaning there were two schools that we gave the tablet computers to. We did training for their teachers on how to use GIS tools, and one school didn't get anything from us because they were the control. And in our two intervention schools, we did see progress overall in test scores and increase in one of the spatial thinking ability categories related to representations as points, lines, and polygons. That if you study cartography, the art and science of map making, points, lines, and polygons are what they call the graphical primitives of a map. And using geographic information system software, there's a really strong emphasis on that. And so in that particular category, we saw a lot of increased ability, less so in things like three-dimensional representation and spatial topology.
And if our listeners are going, well, why would you quiz them on something like this? Well, I don't know if it relates directly to this, but what I find very interesting is you had the students create a three-dimensional map, right, that showed high-risk areas around a school from erosion, possible landslides. Was that all related?
Absolutely, and that's a great example of, you know, disasters and spatial thinking. I mean, it may seem obvious, but just thinking about where you live in relation to other hazards and so forth. So if your village is in a valley that's going to flood and also has high prone for landslides and erosion and so forth, or thinking about farming practice that might deplete the soil, leading to natural hazards and so forth.
I spent a couple of years working in West Virginia, and there were it seemed like every summer there were floods on some of the mountains that had a lot of forestry work done. And the people who lived there, I remember interviewing a woman who said, it floods every year here. It feels like there's nothing on the hillsides to stop this runoff. And every time it rains, it feels like it's coming down into our valley. And she said, it doesn't even have to rain that hard. And I wish someone would study this and tell us, should we just move? And, you know, it was an interesting comment. It stuck with me at that moment. But if you were putting that kind of mapping together, I guess there's multiple functions. Number one, maybe you could decide this is not a viable place for a school or a residence. But number two, if you are going to have it here, what do you do to prepare in case a flood or a disaster happens, I would think?
Right. And that's actually, Nick, a plug for my book. That's a classic example of GIS site selection, which I do a lot with my students, is combining different spatial variables to come up with a site. So, for example, a problem I use a lot is where to put a new school. If you're going to decide where to put a new school in a community, it has to be, say, a certain distance from an existing school, a certain distance from a road, it has to be on a certain level of flat land and so forth. So in the chapter on disaster, I think it's in disaster mitigation, trying to prevent disasters before they even happen, you know, developing, just like the example used in West Virginia, you could develop a GIS site model that could give you a level of prediction. Say, hey, if you build a house here, by the way, there's this, you know, slope of this mountain with this level of runoff that's going to happen. You're likely going to have flooding, so either don't build there or look into some kind of mitigation measure like planting of vegetation on the hill for soil stabilization and so forth. That's a classic use of GIS.
Is there a discomfort for some in accepting this kind of help in mapping, et cetera, because it might reveal that we have, in some communities, done a poor job of planning, of structuring, of deciding where to build things?
Absolutely. Maps are discourse. Maps are power. And so if you're able to produce a map with your message, often a map can be how policy and so forth is instigated. So in today's age, with mapping technology becoming more accessible to wider people, it's becoming interesting because people that normally don't have a voice in those kind of conversations, in some level, have some more power now and agency to create their own maps to add their voice in a planning dialogue like what we're describing.
We're talking to Brian Tomaszewski, assistant professor at Rochester Institute of Technology and the author of the new book, Geographic Information Systems for Disaster Management. It is certainly more of a textbook, but I think it would be functional for anybody in sort of planning it doesn't have to simply exist in a classroom. Where did you intend this book to go?
Yeah, that's a good observation. It tries to serve two audiences. It is written primarily as a textbook, but it was envisioned for either people that are disaster management practitioners or students that want to learn more about GIS technology and the surrounding concepts. But it also is for people that perhaps know a little bit about GIS as a tool and now want to try to understand the domain of disaster management. So I talk a lot about organizations that exist. There's actually an interview with, his name is Scott McCartney. He works here from Monroe County. I have interviews with people from the United Nations, people I've researched with. So it really tries to go across a wide sort of jurisdictional scale of people that work in this area. And I'd like to think that depending on somebody reading it, even if they're not reading it as a textbook, that want to learn how does the United Nations deal with a major international, a multi-country kind of disaster.
How did you fall in love with maps, by the way?
How did I fall in love with maps? I think as a kid, I had an old encyclopedia that my parents were okay with me like cutting up and scribbling on and so forth. And I think I used to just go in that. It was like, no, it was an atlas. And just, I like to draw on maps and so forth.
That's why I think about my own son. I think, do we still have physical maps around? But we now have a huge map of the world in our dining room. And so every night he's looking around. So I was just curious because the book is beautifully done.
Oh, thanks.
And remarkably interesting in how you've kind of compiled the various ways that this kind of management can be used to either respond to or to mitigate or hopefully to educate in ways that allow us to prevent these disasters. And I think those things go hand in hand. Let me ask Amina Qatari, are you a spatial thinker? How would you do on a spatial thinking test?
I don't know. I was actually trying to think how would I respond to that. But I'm actually learning a lot with Brian. We're working on a project together. So I've started to think more about the value of thinking, especially with crisis management.
Yeah, Amina Qatari is from RIT's School of Communication. And originally you're from where?
Tanzania.
And put us on the map. I don't know how many of us could identify Tanzania right away. Where on the map, Amina?
If you know where Mount Kilimanjaro is, mm-hmm. That's where Tanzania is. So it's in Tanzania.
And we've talked this hour about the value of information sharing, spreading, whether it's Solomon talking about this app and helping us track disease or simply alerting communities to options that they might not know about. But we are tuned to thinking that we all have information, that it's easy, that we all have a cell phone, that there's information for all of us. Are we taking it for granted here, Amina?
I think so, yes. And I think in my research, actually, we started out in Tanzania. I'm also looking to apply it here in low-income communities as well. So there is this assumption that everybody has a smartphone, which is not true, not only globally, but also in the U.S. as well. And also with a smartphone, you need to have a data plan. And also if you are going to be downloading apps, there is this assumption that those apps are going to be updated. They are constantly going to be in use versus texting, which is a given now with even the simple phones or dumb phones, as Salman said. In Tanzania, where my research started, there are people in the urban area who do have smartphones. There are apps available there too. But texting is the preferred way of communicating because, for one, receiving text messages is free. So if you are trying to reach a mass audience, you can push out a message without them having to pay to receive your message. So there is value in doing that. And because there is still need for information, Tanzania is a poor country. It's still developing. And there is a need for information in rural areas especially. And so there are a lot of people in the rural area who have very simple phones with text messaging ability. So you can push out messages to them. And what my research is trying to do is that there have been a lot of studies, there have been a lot of initiatives that are targeted towards masses. So you send out text messages, whether it's an awareness campaign or intervention, but there isn't a feedback loop. So one thing that I've been testing is to find out if there is a way to create a system where people could actually send feedback in a sustainable way. So instead of just saying, sending a text message back saying, yes, I got the message, they could ask a question and then actually receive a reply.
Okay, and so that's where we're going with this. So they could ask a question, maybe get a reply. On what kind of subjects? What do you want to see change here?
Okay, so my research so far had focused on HIV. And even though HIV is not a new thing in Tanzania or many African countries anymore, there is still need of information, especially when it comes to medication, new types of infections coming up, and there is still a lot of stigma. So while there are a lot of awareness campaigns, you know, you need to use condoms or how to go about having relationships that are not going to put you at a risk, what happens if you think you might have symptoms? People are still reluctant to go to a clinic and get tested. So what we are trying to do is set up a system where you could text to a number that would give information about where can you go to get tested and even receive your results via text message that would be confidential, only you would get it, so without having to be physically tied to a place and being identified.
So this is a very sort of modernist way of looking at the way people are thinking about, as you say, stigma. So this privacy helps with stigma.
Yes.
And simple human behavior. People are, even Tanzanian and in African countries, they're communicating via text message. And you think they're much more likely to use this form of communication than going to public clinics, those kind of things. So this is more effective, you think?
It is, and I actually received a seed grant from RIT, and so I did some field work last year, actually 2 years. So in 2013, I received a small grant. I actually did a survey to find out what information needs that are out there. So what is it that people still want information about? And then if there was a system in place like this, what would convince them to use it? And as we talked earlier, yes, people download apps. You know, there is a disaster. You communicate with it, and then once that is over, you delete it or you forget about it. So how do you keep people interacting with it over a long period of time? And so what we found was some of the barriers would be cost. So as I mentioned, it's free to receive messages, and the people who really need information, they don't have a lot of money. And while texting is not expensive if you consider by our standards here, it still costs money if you are going to be sending out messages. So we have to find a way to make it free. There is a text-based system here in the U.S., Text for Baby, which is funded by a national organization. And I think there's a buy-in from most of the U.S. carriers, so you don't have to pay if you are texting back as an individual. The other question was privacy, because if you are going to be asking questions, is your information going to be collected and used against you? Fortunately for now, there is no caller ID with cell phones, so if you sign up for the system, your number is not connected to your name, although that might change in the future. And the third concern is credibility of the information. Mm-hmm. So who is going to be giving you that information?
And do you have the infrastructure to simply have the staffing to respond, right? I mean, so how do you do that?
So because this is really a case study, I was working, and I'm working with the National AIDS Organization. That's a government agency, and they would be in charge. But the way this would work, when the system was in place, it could go at a community level. So a community clinic could sign up and say, you send a message to this number, and this doctor who works in this clinic, who is part of this community, is going to respond. So there also creates a network which is community-based rather than top-down coming from Dar es Salaam or at the national level.
Okay, so what's next? How do you put this into action now?
So what I did last year was after the survey, I went back and I actually did focus groups. So the other thing that came up, because I also wanted to find out if the doctors would be willing to use it, because this would be asking for some extra work from them. You know, they have a full-time job.
Sure.
They're working in the clinic. They're busy. And now if they sign up to answer questions from people who might not be their patients to begin with, one concern was, there, am I going to be bombarded with text messages all the time? I cannot reply to them while I'm tending to my patients in my clinic. So they were thinking there has to be a time, or there has to be a gatekeeper who would collect those messages and even create some standard messages that could be sent out and really take it to the community level. The main thing right now is to figure out how to make this free for people to actually send those messages to the people who have the answers. Otherwise, it's not sustainable. So I'm looking for external funding to test this nationwide in Tanzania.
And if you can test this nationwide in Tanzania, the best case scenario is that happens how soon?
Well, if you know with funding, I mean, I've tried last year. I'm trying again this year. So it would take a year.
Mm-hmm.
I already have someone I work with. So the system is in place. It's online. We tested it at a very small scale, but I need to go in different communities around the country. Once it's up and running, in maybe 2-3 years.
I think Americans in general are, I think understandably so. I am ignorant about AIDS in Africa, but I'm very impressed with just the way you're approaching the problem and giving people a very personal but still very private chance to ask questions. Very, very important stuff. Good luck.
Thank you.
And yes, we've talked many times to many researchers about the paucity of funding sometimes, and that can be a challenge. So we shall see. I hope you'll keep us informed on that. Let me grab one phone call. Bud in Chile, I had a question for Brian Tomaszewski. Go ahead, Bud.
Well, yeah. I'm using Google Maps for a totally different situation. I'm writing the history of my hometown up in Newfane, north of Lockport. And the creek that runs from Lockport to Olcott is really fundamental in the formation of that town and its success. Well, I have gone up there a few times and tried to locate relics of old dams and bridges and things that are long gone. And it's very confusing when you're driving around, but I did find some old maps, and then I decided to use Google Maps, and as soon as I did that, I was able to pinpoint where all of these places were. I'd seen them, but I didn't know I was even looking at them, and now I've nailed it down just by using Google Maps.
Okay,
that's great.
If anybody's doing like their family history or something, if they start off by going, or you know, once they know a little bit about the area, if they do use Google Maps and just start looking around, they'll pick up some insights they probably never had before.
Thank you, Bud. Brian, what do you think?
I think that's great, and I think that's fantastic you're using maps for your own historical research. My background actually is in archaeology. So when you were asking me before about maps, why I got into maps, I used to do archaeology, which is very spatial in nature. I'd also recommend that you take a look at Google Earth. And Google Earth has some pre-layers that come on sort of automatically if you look for them. And there's something called the David Rumsey Map Collection, which is a fantastic collection of digital historical maps for all over the world. And you may, if you zoom in on Western New York, there may be something there of interest to add more context to your story.
Great stuff. Yeah. Brian, thank you. And Bud, thanks for the phone call. You've been hearing Brian Tomaszewski, assistant professor at Rochester Institute of Technology, the RIT professor who wrote the book Geographic Information Systems for Disaster Management. Great job with this, and thanks for your perspective this hour.
Thank you.
And Amina Qatari, good luck to you, also from RIT, and with this ambitious project. I certainly would love to see it work, and I hope you'll share with us the results as you go forward.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Have a wonderful week, and our thanks to John Andrus, the engineer today, to Barsook Records and Ra Ra Riot for providing the music for this program. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for listening to Connections on member-supported public radio.